This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Bookmark. I'm Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan, and this is 50 Books in 50 Weeks, brought to you in collaboration with Borders. Throughout the month of September, I've been taking a look at some essential children's reads. The Wind in the Willows, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Alice in Wonderland, books by two Englishmen and a Welshman. This week, I'm going stateside. Now, the stylistic eccentricities of Maurice Sendak, Shel Silverstein, and Theodore Geisel, also known as Dr. Seuss, are so much a part of the childhood vernacular today that it's hard to imagine their books were once considered by some to be wholly inappropriate for children. Yet these were three authors who challenged the conception of what a children's book should be. And children's literature, happily, has never been the same. Once upon a more staid time, the purpose of children's books was to model good behavior. They were meant to edify and to encourage young readers to be what parents wanted them to be. And the children in their pages were well-behaved, properly attired, and devoid of tears. Children's literature was not supposed to shine a light on the way children actually were, or delight in the slovenly, self-interested, and disobedient side of their natures. Seuss, Sendak, and Silverstein ignored all of these rules. They brought a shock, a subversion to the genre, defying the notion that children's books shouldn't be scary or silly or sophisticated. Rather than reprimand the wayward listener, their books encouraged bad or perhaps just even human behavior. Now, I promise I'll eventually get to Seuss and Sendak on this list, but today I'm talking about a book that I never had the opportunity to read as a child. I was all grown up by the time I picked up Shel Silverstein, but he nevertheless managed to invoke a sense of childlike wonder.
This morning I jumped on my horse and went out for a ride, and some wild Indians chased me and they shot me in the side. So I crawled into a wildcat's den to find a place to hide. But some bandits found me sleeping, and soon they had me tied to a post and built a fire. Under me I almost cried, till a mermaid came and cut me loose and begged to be my bride. So I said I'd come back Wednesday, but I must admit I lied, 'cause I ran into a jungle swamp. But I forgot my guide, and I stepped into some quicksand, and no matter how I tried, I couldn't get out until I met a water snake named Clyde, who pulled me to some cannibals to have plan to have me fried. But an eagle came and swooped me up, and through the air we flied, and he dropped me in a chocolate lake that was 1,000 miles wide, and you'll never guess what I did then. I died.
A jack of all trades, Shel Silverstein had a successful career as a cartoonist before immersing himself in the realm of children's books. In fact, Silverstein admits that he never planned to write or draw for kids, until, that is, a friend of his, Tommy Ungerer, insisted, practically dragged him kicking and screaming into the world of children's books. And thank goodness for that.
If you tell me the wild boar has 20 teeth, I'll say, why, sure. Or say that he has 33. That number's quite all right with me. Or scream that he has 99. I'll never say that you are lying. For the number of teeth in a wild boar's mouth is a subject I'm glad I know nothing about.
One of the opening poems in Shel Silverstein's Don't Bump the Glump and Other Fantasies, originally published in 1964, features a creature named the Gletcher. In one very short poem, Silverstein manages to convey the creature's fearsome nature. He has very sharp claws and more than enough teeth. But Silverstein goes on to note, gratefully, that it's a good thing this monster is locked up in its cage, or we'd all be in terrible trouble. And then the illustration shows an empty cage hanging from a ceiling. The door's been busted open, and the creature has escaped. I loved that poem so much. To me, it communicated the sheer brilliance of Silverstein's works for children. Thank goodness the legendary children's book editor Ursula Nordstrom published his books for children. Thank goodness he didn't stay locked up in the world of adult books, or we might all be in terrible trouble. Children's literature would be a lot more boring and a lot less risky had he not busted out.
Listen to the mustn'ts, child. Listen to the don'ts. Listen to the shouldn'ts, the impossibles, the won'ts. Listen to the never-haves, Then listen close to me. Anything can happen, child. Anything can be.
But it was his second collection, published in 1974, that remains a perennial favourite. Where the Sidewalk Ends, it begins with an invitation.
If you are a dreamer, come in. If you are a dreamer, a wisher, a liar, a hoper, a prayer, a magic bean buyer, if you are a pretender, come, sit by my fire. For we have some flax golden tales to spin. Come in. Come in.
And what follows is 176 pages filled with all lengths of poems, from short and to the point to three-page narratives and everything in between. The poems are by turns funny, poignant, irreverent, imaginative, naughty, silly, sad, enchanting, quirky, witty, giddy, and zany. Nearly everyone is accompanied by a drawing that sometimes gives the reader a little more clarification and sometimes simply illustrates what's already there in the printed word.
18 luscious, scrumptious flavors, chocolate, lime, and cherry. Coffee, pumpkin, fudge, banana, caramel, cream, and boysenberry. Rocky road, toasted almond, butterscotch, vanilla dip, butter, brittle, apple, ripple, coconut, and mocha chip, brandy, peach, and lemon custard. Each scoop lovely, smooth, and round, tallest ice cream cone in town, lying there on the ground.
It is a collection that has something for everyone, from the littlest of kids to the oldest of adults. There are poems that bring back memories, poke fun at life, and give advice, admittedly somewhat twisted advice, like why you shouldn't pick your nose, or whether or not to believe that the world is indeed round. But the message is there. It's subtle, but it's there.
My beard grows to my toes. I never wears no clothes. I wraps my hair around my bear and down the road I goes. La 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 lum pa bum pa bum pa bum pa bum bum. La 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 lum pee dum pee doo dee da da la lum pa dum pee dee.
Some of the poems tell tales, revel in silliness, make light of small anxieties, and give voice to outrageous things a kid would never ever do, but always wondered what would happen if they did, like bathe an armadillo, or make a hippopotamus sandwich, or spit from the 26th floor. Still, other rhymes play with words or make you think, are we really so different? Do I really want to grow up all that fast? Maybe some risks are worth taking. There are poems that describe quintessential childhood pranks and reassure kids that they're not the only ones going through stuff in life, like bad days, thumb sucking, older siblings picking on them, younger siblings bugging them, or learning how hard it is to try just to be good. And then there are those uproariously funny poems that make you laugh out loud as you read about things like pants that dance, double-tailed dogs, eating with your toes, and the infamous Dirty Dan.
Her mama said, don't eat with your fingers.
Okay, said Ridiculous Rose.
So, she ate with her toes.
After this, I'll tell you just where the sidewalk ends. You're listening to 50 Books in 50 Weeks, brought to you in collaboration with Borders. This is Bookmark on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Hungry Mungry sat at supper, took his knife and spoon and fork, ate a bowl of mushroom soup, ate a slice of roasted pork, ate a dozen stewed tomatoes, 27 deviled eggs, 15 shrimp, 9 baked potatoes, 32 fried chicken legs, shank of lamb, boiled ham, 2 bowls of grits, some black-eyed peas, 4 chocolate shakes, 8 angel cakes, 9 custard pies with Munster cheese, 10 pots of tea. And after he had eaten all that he was able, he poured some broth on a tablecloth and ate the kitchen table. Part 1. Part 2. His parents said, oh, Hungry Mungry, stop those silly jokes. Mungry opened up his mouth and he ate his folks. And then he went and ate his house and chewed the bricks and wood. And then he ate up all the people in the neighborhood. And up came 20 angry policemen shouting, "Stop and cease!" Mungry opened up his mouth and he ate the police. Soldiers came with tanks and guns. Said Mungry, "They can't harm me." He smiled, and then he licked his chops, and he ate the U.S. Army. The president sent all his bombers. Mungry still was calm, put his head back, gulped the planes, and gobbled up the bomb. He ate the town and ate the city, ate and ate and ate, and then he said, "I think I'll eat the whole United States." And so he ate Chicago first and munched the water tower. And then he chewed on Pittsburgh, but he found it rather sour. He ate New York and Tennessee and all of Boston town, and then he drank the Mississippi just to wash it down. And then, once he'd eaten every state, each puppy, boy, and girl, he wiped his mouth upon his sleeve and went to eat the world. There's something for you. He ate the Egypt pyramids and every church in Rome and all the grass in Africa, and all the ice in Nome. He ate each hill in green Brazil. And then, to make things worse, he decided for the dessert he would eat the universe. He started with the moon and stars, and soon as he was done, he gobbled up the clouds and sipped the wind. And chopped the sun, and sitting there in the cold, dark air, he started to nibble his feet until nothing was left but the sound of a nothing was left to eat.
This is the place where the sidewalk ends, and before the street begins, and where the grass grows soft and white, and where the sun burns crimson bright, and where the moon bird rests from his flight to cool in the peppermint wind. Let us leave this place where the smoke blows black and the dark street winds and bends, past the pits where the asphalt flowers grow. We shall walk with a walk that is measured and slow, and watch where the chalk-white arrows go, to the place where the sidewalk ends. Yes, we'll walk with a walk that is measured and slow, and we'll go where the chalk-white arrows go, for the children they mark, and the children they know, the place where the sidewalk ends. You're listening to Bookmark on The Bigger Picture. I'm Uma Paganampike Pagan, and this is 50 Books in 50 Weeks, brought to you in collaboration with Borders. It can be argued that Shel Silverstein is one of America's greatest children's book authors. His words and stories continue to be relevant, and decades after publication, people still identify with his books and poems, regardless of how old they are.
Spaghetti, spaghetti all over the place, up to my elbows, up to my face, over the carpet, under the chairs, into the hammock, wound round the stairs, filling the bathtub, covering a desk, making the sofa a mad, mushy mess. The party is ruined. I'm terribly worried. The guests have all left, unless they're all buried. I told them, bring presents. I said, throw confetti. I guess they heard me wrong. They all threw spaghetti.
Reading Where the Sidewalk Ends often includes a personal sense of discovery, and it is probably for that reason that the poem continues to inspire. Its message, to me at least, is somewhat simple. We have a tendency to get caught up in life. We forget to look out of the window every now and then and appreciate all that surrounds us. Plans are set, and the fear of drifting keeps us on this designated course. There are so many rules and limitations that are defined by our culture and society that it often leaves us feeling trapped and confined. That place where the sidewalk ends, is a place where we can be free. Silverstein tells us to leave the place behind where the smoke blows black and the dark street winds and bends. Because if we leave worry and fear behind and take a step or two off the paved path, we will find a place where the grass is greener and the sun burns brighter. And that sounds like a pretty cool place to me.
There was a boy in our town with long hair. I mean, really long hair. So everybody pointed at him and laughed at him and made fun of him and stare. And when he walked down the street, people would roar and stick out their tongues and make funny faces and run in and slam the door and shout at him from the windows till he couldn't stand it anymore. So he sat down and cried, trying to cover his hair so no one would look. He sobbed and he sighed. till his whole body shook, and pretty soon his hair shook too. And it flapped and flapped, and he lifted, and it flew straight up in the air like a helicopter. Jenny Rick saw him and dropped her knitting and screamed, "It's a flying kid!" Lukeski Hastings run and hid under old man Merrill's car. Miss Terrence fainted. Henry Quist tried to shoot him down but missed. "I thought it was a crow," he said. And round he sailed all through the day, smiling in the strangest way, with the wind in his hair and the sun in his eyes. We saw him swoop and bank and rise. He brushed the treetops, skimmed the grass on Yerby's lawn, almost crashed right into Hanson's silo, but zoomed up again and almost hit the courthouse. Old man Cooley bit right through his napkin when he saw a kid fly through the diner door and out the window, tipping the ladder where Smokey was painting. He almost had a heart attack. He clung to the rafter. The kid flew on, us running after him, cheering and screaming and shouting, "Hooray!" And Mayor Lowry shouted, "Hey, come down here, kid. We'd like to say how proud of you we are today. Whoever thought our little town would have a hero in it? And so I'd like to proclaim this day. Hey, kid, will you come down for just a minute?" But the kid did not come down. He treaded air above the ground, flapping his hair and looking down at all of us here on the ground. And then he flew up into the clouds, flapping and flying so far and high, out past the hills and up into the sky, until a tiny speck against the sun was all we could see of him, and he was gone.
There were two things that all children would immediately sense about Shel Silverstein. First was that he was fearless. He didn't care much for the norms of children's literature. He was perfectly fine with scaring our pants off. Just remember that sharp-toothed snail that lives inside everyone's nose. But most of all, it was that he never, ever, not once, talked down to us. There were a lot of children's books that did, and we immediately loathed them. Here was a mischief maker. He wasn't going to waste his time singing pretty ditties to us. He was going to challenge and frighten us.
"When singing songs of scariness, of bloodiness and hairiness, I feel obligated at this moment to remind you of the most ferocious beast of all, 3,000 pounds and 9 feet tall, the glurpy, sclurpy, squagagah that's standing right behind you."
Just look at the very cover of Where the Sidewalk Ends. Children, even the timid ones, will always want to go to the edge of the world where the wild wind whirls, where we're told to keep off and consider taking a peek. Because a little fear never hurt anyone. In fact, it might even be good for us.
"If I had a brontosaurus, I would name him Horace or Morris. But if suddenly one day he had a lot of little brontosauri, I would change his name to Laurie."
Silverstein encouraged us to play with words, and in doing so, encouraged us to learn how to fight, love, and reach each other with those words. Shel Silverstein lived outside the box, way, way outside the box. He lived nowhere near that box. He lived in a world well past it, miles past where the sidewalk ends. Next week, Morris Sendak and Where the Wild Things Are. This is 50 Books in 50 Weeks, brought to you in collaboration with Borders, Bookmark, The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
"I'll sing you a poem of a silly young king who played with the world at the end of a string, but he only loved one single thing, and that was just a peanut butter sandwich. His scepter and his royal gowns, his regal throne and golden crowns were all brown and sticky from the mounds and drippings from each peanut butter sandwich. His subjects all were silly fools, for he had passed a royal rule that all that they could learn in school was how to make a peanut butter sandwich. He would not eat his sovereign steak. No, he scorned his soup, take it away, and his kingly cake, and told his courtly cook to bake an extra sticky peanut butter sandwich. And then, one day, he took a bite and started chewing with delight. Oh, delight.
yikes. But he found that his mouth was stuck quite tight from that last bite of peanut butter sandwich.
His brother pulled, his sister pried, the wizard pushed,
his mother cried, my boy's committed suicide from eating that last peanut butter sandwich.
The dentist came, and the royal duck, the royal plumber, banged, and knocked, but still those jaws stayed tightly locked. Oh, damn that sticky peanut butter sandwich. The carpenter, he tried with pliers. The telephone man tried with wires. The firemen, they tried with fire. Oh, but couldn't melt that peanut butter sandwich. With ropes and pulleys, drills and coil, with steam and lubricating oil, for 20 years of tears and toil, they fought that awful peanut butter sandwich. And then all his royal subjects came. They hooked his jaws with grappling chains and pulled both ways with might and main against that stubborn peanut butter sandwich. Each man and woman, girl and boy, put down their plows and pots and toys and pulled until crack!
Oh, joy. They broke right through. Peanut butter sandwich. A puff of dust. A screech. A squeak. The king's jaws opened with a creak. And then, in voice so faint and weak, the first words that they heard him speak were, how about a peanut butter sandwich?
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.